From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air for Veterans Day, the story of one of the first big battles in our war in Vietnam. The Battle of Ia Drang lasted 4 days. We'll talk to the general who led the battle and the journalist who covered it. They both say it was the worst battle they've ever seen. Also, the art of picking the timeless quotation. We talk with Justin Kaplan, editor of the 16th edition of Bartlett's Quotations. The new edition includes quotes from Ronald Reagan, Garrison Keillor, and Zippy the Pinhead. And classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews a reissue of recordings by the late contralto Kathleen Ferrier. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect Bill Clinton took part in a Veterans Day ceremony at the state capitol in Little Rock, Arkansas. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton's effort to avoid military service was an issue that dogged him during the campaign, and he has gone to great lengths to prove he would be a strong commander-in-chief. Today, at a Veterans Day event in Little Rock, he repeated statements he's made during the campaign that he will support a strong military and promote programs to help service members who lose their jobs in the defense build-down. Clinton was asked about his intentions to sign an executive order lifting the ban on gays in the military. He has said he intends to issue such an order. Today, he said he wanted to discuss the mechanics of lifting the ban with the military. Clinton also announced he would be holding his first press conference tomorrow and that he would be traveling to Washington next Wednesday to meet with congressional leaders and possibly President Bush. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
A Russian official told a Senate committee today that the former Soviet Union held 6 Americans prisoner on spy charges during the Korean War. General Dmitry Volkoganov also said that the KGB helped 9 Americans to desert during the Vietnam War so that they could help in anti-war propaganda. Volkoganov is the co-chairman of a joint U.S. and Russian task force on POWs. He testified before the Senate Committee on POW and MIA Affairs on the results of the latest investigations of Soviet intelligence files from the Stalin era. A ceasefire throughout Bosnia was scheduled to go into effect about an hour ago, but UN peacekeepers are worried that continued fighting today could jeopardize the truce. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports.
Fierce artillery and infantry clashes broke out today in the city of Mostar, Bosnia's second largest city. All 3 warring factions, Serbs, Muslims, and Croats, yesterday signed what they called an unconditional ceasefire agreement in Sarajevo. Numerous previous ceasefires have failed since war broke out in Bosnia in April. Today, UN peacekeeping officials said they could not guarantee comprehensive monitoring of the truce because their troop contingent of 7,000 will not be fully deployed until probably next week. There was increased concern today over the possibility that the conflict could spread to Serbia itself, following a clash between ethnic Albanians and Yugoslav federal soldiers in the Serbian province of Kosovo. An Albanian student was killed in what the army called a terrorist act against an officer's club. Albanian leaders claim it was a provocation. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street, despite the fact that the U.S. Treasury, many banks and businesses were closed for the Veterans Day holiday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 15 points to finish at 3,240. Advances led declines by nearly 2-1. This is NPR News. The Prime Minister of Lithuania said today that the crisis in Yugoslavia shows that the West will no longer come to the aid of small countries that face aggression. Alexandras Abisala said that he fears the Western nations would do nothing to stop Russia if it were to invade Lithuania and the other Baltic nations. The Lithuanian Prime Minister is on an official visit to the United States, where he'll meet with Acting Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger. Relations between the Baltic nations and Russia have been strained by disputes over the withdrawal of former Soviet troops and the costs of Russian oil and natural gas. An international conference on Palestinian refugees is continuing in Ottawa without the Israeli delegation. Israel walked out of the talks because it claims the head of the Palestinian delegation is connected to the Palestine Liberation Organization. Jennifer Ludden reports.
Israeli officials have long maintained a policy of not negotiating with the Palestine Liberation Organization, Earlier conferences have gone as planned in accordance with this stipulation. But today Israel balked when Mohammed Halaj showed up as leader of the Palestinian delegation. Halaj heads the Palestinian National Council, which Israel claims is a branch of the PLO. An effort to persuade Halaj to leave the talks failed. The current round of negotiations is scheduled to last 2 days. It concerns the fate of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees in Syria and Lebanon. The conference is part of ongoing talks on achieving peace in the Middle East. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Ludden reporting.
The Colombian government pledged today to stamp out political violence, but a new round of terrorist bombings hit major Colombian cities. At least 39 people were hurt in bombings in the cities of Cali and Medellin. Colombian television reported that the government is offering a reward worth about $1.4 million for the capture of two main rebel leaders. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Veterans Day, my guests are remembering a battle they survived 27 years ago this week. It was the first major land battle the Americans fought in Vietnam. It was also the bloodiest. Both sides claimed victory. Both sides suffered tremendous losses. My guests are Lieutenant General Harold Moore, who led the campaign, and Joseph Galloway, who was a 23-year-old reporter at the time, covering the battle for UPI. General Moore led 450 men of the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, into the Ia Drang Valley. They never expected to be surrounded by 2,000 North Vietnamese soldiers. Reinforcements came from both sides. The battle ended with 230 Americans dead, 240 wounded, and 3,000 North Vietnamese dead. General Moore is now retired. Joseph Galloway is a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. They've collaborated on the new book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, Ia Drang, the Battle That Changed the War in Vietnam. General Moore says the worst-case scenario happened early on in the battle when one of his platoons was cut off from the rest of the battalion.
That happened because we had a very aggressive lieutenant who was ordered to go up to the rest of the company through this scrub jungle and get on their flank and give them mutual support. In other words, tie in with them on their right flank. This lieutenant and his platoon encountered 3 to 4 North Vietnamese as they got to the rest of their company. And he ordered his men to take off after them, which they did. They got out 300 yards away from the rest of the company, away from everyone else, and were cut off, surrounded and cut off from the rest of the battalion.
What's your responsibility when that happens?
Quite simple. My responsibility was to try to get them back and get to them and keep them from being overrun. As it turned out, the platoon leader was killed within minutes. The next in command, the platoon sergeant, was killed. And command came down to a buck sergeant, 3 stripes, who took command of the platoon. And he formed them into a perimeter, brought in fire support, artillery and air, and we held this enemy off as we tried to attack to get to them. It took us over 24 hours to get to them, but when we got to them and rescued them, they still had ammunition with which to fight.
General, you weren't prepared for the size of the Vietnamese force that you faced. What were you prepared to find and how many men were actually there against you?
Okay. About 10 minutes before we took off for the Ia Drang Valley in the initial assault, I received information that there were 3 battalions of enemy, and a battalion of North Vietnamese is around 500 men, that there were 3 battalions of the enemy within 2 miles of our landing zone. And so I sifted this through my head and immediately realized that we could be into a fight almost immediately upon landing. And which indeed we were. Within 45 minutes, we were in the first major battle of the war between a large American force and North Vietnamese forces. I say large because eventually I got 3 or 4 hours later the rest of my battalion on the ground, but at first we only had 80 to 100. And it was a very, very sporty occasion, let me assure you.
Joe Galloway, I'm going to ask you to describe what it was like to be on the ground in the middle of a battle in which there was rocket fire, bombs, cannons, ground artillery.
This was shocking. This was overwhelming noise. You couldn't hear yourself think. The second morning, the enemy launched a major attack on the southeast side of this little football-sized clearing. And all of a sudden, this thunderous attack erupts, and we're right behind the company that's being hit. And the machine gun fire and the rifle fire and the rocket grenades of the enemy that pass through that company are landing on us. Men next to me fell over with a bullet in the head. I was lying down as close to the ground as I could get. Seemed like the right thing to do. When I felt the toe of a combat boot in my ribs, and I sort of turned my head and tilted up and looked, and it was the battalion sergeant major, a man 6'3" tall, a big bear of a guy. And he bent over at the waist and sort of yelled down at me so I could just hear him. And what he said shocked me. He said, "Sonny, you can't take no pictures laying down there on the ground." And I thought about that for a minute, and I realized he's right. I can't do my job down here. And the other thing that crossed my mind is I think we're probably all going to be killed, and if that's the case, I'd just as soon take mine standing up anyway. So I got up and went about my business.
What did you shoot?
I was carrying a Nikon camera and an M16 rifle, and on occasion I used them both.
Did your pictures turn out from the battle?
The pictures were... For somebody who was as scared as I was, they weren't too bad.
General, when bombs are falling and there's artillery fire all around and you're under attack, this is the question of somebody who's never served or been in battle. But how do you think clearly? I mean, this is the time when you are most required to think clearly, but when it must be most difficult to do so.
I really have never had any problem. Thinking clearly in a tough, time-critical situation, I think I kind of go into a sort of a C-zone and blank out all the horrible brutality which is going on around me, being aware of it nevertheless, but realizing that I was a commander, I am a commander, and I am responsible for preserving as many American lives as I can and killing as many enemies as I can. Now, in the smoke and the dust, which limits visibility, and the terrible heat, that compounds the situation. The men screaming and yelling, giving orders in three languages, English, Spanish, Vietnamese, wounded men screaming for medics and for their mother about to die. I've never found it difficult to keep my head in situations like that. I'm a paratrooper. I've had a couple of malfunctions. Once I was 8 seconds from hitting the ground, but I knew I'd make it in on my reserve if I could get it open. So I've never really been concerned when I've been in a tough situation. Just do the job.
I guess you can't allow yourself to get too emotional about your men dying in the middle of a fight.
No, you cannot. And furthermore, you cannot impart by your very manner and your voice on the radio any possible sign or word or tone of voice that would indicate to any listener or any of your men looking at you that you were rattled. You had to look cool and be cool, and it's something you can't put on.
What about when the battle's over and you don't have to be cool and you don't have to be an emotional? Does it get you in a different way then?
Yep. That's when it's always hit me. In this battle, I looked around on the ground and saw many of my precious men in their ponchos lying dead. Men whom I have trained for 18 months, knew their wives, children, many of them, knew them very closely. And I knew a terrible truth that 24 hours later would shatter the hearts of their families back home in America. And that got to me. Darn right it did. And I never a day goes by in the 27 years since that battle that I don't refight it in my mind and think about those great Americans who never backed off, many of them who had only 7 to 10 days left in the service. And they went home in coffins. And I'm forever grateful for their service, and I grieve for them forever. And for years, I felt guilty that I was not killed. I guess that's a normal reaction from a commander who loves his men.
You don't feel that way anymore?
I've kind of gotten over it a little bit. A few years back, several of my troopers told me at one of these reunions, they said, "Colonel," and they still call me Colonel, which is fine, "Colonel, you got to stop feeling that way, because if you died in that place, none of us would have got out of there." Well, I don't know if that's true or false, but that made me feel better.
We're talking about the Battle of Ia Drang in Vietnam. My guests are Lieutenant General Harold Moore, who led the campaign, and Joseph Galloway, who covered the battle for UPI. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lieutenant General Harold Moore and journalist Joseph Galloway, and they've collaborated on a book about a battle that General Moore led and Joseph Galloway covered. The book is called We Were Soldiers Once and Young, Ia Drang, the Battle That Changed the War in Vietnam. Now, this battle lasted 4 days and four nights. Did you get any sleep at all, either of you, during the length of the battle?
I didn't get any sleep. Along about the early morning of the third day, my mind was still functioning clearly and cleanly and quickly. Do that on adrenaline or just on training and stamina. But the curious thing that happened was that I had to think every word before I would say it into the radio or to people around me. It was like translating English into English, if you can understand what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Joe, did you get any sleep, and were you functioning well?
Well, I was functioning. Sleep sort of leaves your mind. When I'd gone out to that tea plantation, I'd been on the perimeter with one of Colonel Moore's, his Bravo company. And that was foxholes and alarms all night and 100% alert, so I got no sleep that night, and I got no sleep the next night. And I think it was on the last night we were in there, somewhere about 2 o'clock in the morning, it kind of caught up with me. And I remember leaning back against a tree, and the last thing I remember for about an hour and a half until the shooting started again was I remember that same fellow who booted me up onto my feet in the middle of the firestorm. I remember him kneeling down, the sergeant major, and putting a poncho liner over me and tucking me in like I was his son or his grandchild. And I thought, what a tender gesture from such a tough man. And I did. I just conked out. I slept for a couple of hours. I was awakened by the renewed fighting and came up out of the poncho liner and went back to work. Some of that work, I would say, you're not so much a news person in those circumstances as you are of another set of hands.
Mm-hmm.
You can be of use. You can carry the wounded. You can bring water. You can carry ammunition.
Did you carry the wounded?
I did. The one memory that will never leave my mind is what they call a friendly fire incident that occurred on the second day. And we were around the command post, and someone said, "My God, look." And I looked up, and there were two canisters of napalm that had just been released by a U.S. Air Force F-100 jet, and they were coming directly at us. And there was his wingman was behind him and alongside. And if the first set of napalm cans didn't get us, the second were surely going to. And I can remember Colonel Moore screaming, "Get him to pull up, pull up, pull up." And the Charlie Hastings, the Air Force forward controller, on the radio screaming at that pilot. The damage was done with the first two, but we could maybe stop the second plane from dropping his, and Charlie managed to do that. But the other two, just like slow motion, coming down at us, the officer next to me, he knew something I didn't know, that if you are caught in napalm, the one thing you need to do is protect your eyes. And he turned and he put his face into my shoulder and protected his eyes while I just watched them come. And they went just directly over our heads. And they struck in the middle of a couple of small foxholes where our engineer detachment were dug in the grass. And the napalm engulfed them, and we could see them dancing in the fire. And as soon as that napalm died down and we could run out into that smoldering grass, we did. And a man loomed up in the smoke, and he said, "Get this man by his feet." And I reached, and I caught his ankles. And when I did, the nylon of the combat boots crumbled in my hands, and the flesh came off, and I could feel the bones of his ankles in the palms of my hands. And you never ever forget something like that. Those men lay for an hour or so in our little makeshift aid station right beside us, screaming in pain in spite of all the morphine in the world. This affects you. You're no longer you can't be a detached observer in those circumstances. These are people who are giving their lives to save yours.
I'd like to ask you both if during the battle, when you probably thought there was a good chance you would die, if you made any bargains with God or made any promises about what you would do if you did live.
I did not. I was very young at the time, just turned 24. I had thought about this myself, and I thought, this is a possibility, but I'd have no wife, I have no children. This is my life I'm risking, and it would cause some pain to my mother and father, but it's worth the risk. Now, I went to war again when I was 49 years old, and I rode with the tanks of the 24th Infantry Division into the Euphrates River Valley, deep in Iraq. And that was different. I'm married, I have two young sons, 12 and 15, and all the way across that desert, I thought about them. And I thought about, once again, the young men who were riding with me. And I did do some talking to God on that ride, and what I said was, "God, don't send me back into another Iadrang Valley. I've been there, and these kids don't need to see that."
General, let me ask you if you ever made any bargains with God when you were thinking that this might be the end.
No. You got to remember now that I was a West Point graduate, professional Army officer, trained in all the Army schools. I'd been through battle in the Korean War as an infantry company commander of two infantry companies. And I'd seen battle before. And in that war and in the Vietnam War, I never did any bargaining with God. I never thought about my wife and five kids back in America. The thing I thought about was my troopers on the ground and accomplishing my mission. And I never gave a thought in any fight I've ever been in two wars, whether or not I'd get hit. If I got hit, I got hit. That's it. My job was to lead troops. And to lead them, you got to be on the battlefield, and you cannot be fearful. You got to keep your cool. And I never knelt down. It never crossed my mind that we would go down in that fight against great odds. I knew in my heart that we would prevail. We had massive fire support. We had disciplined troops, and we were tough, and we were good. And it never entered my mind to make a personal bargain with God for me or for my men. I knew we'd win.
Did you win?
I think we did. We walked across their bodies by the score on the morning of the third day. We picked up hundreds of weapons, which is they usually try to get out of there. They bring them all the way down from North Vietnam. They want to keep them. That battlefield was littered with enemy bodies, and he broke contact and headed to the west for his Cambodian base camps. My mind, we won the Battle at LZ X-Ray. He was determined to overrun and kill us all, and he did not do that. I lost 79 killed and 121 men wounded, including my attached units, and that's a terrible price to pay. But he did not kill us all, as he obviously intended to do.
The anniversary of the Battle of Ia Drang is this week. Do you, either of you do anything special on the anniversary of the battle every year?
Oh, you bet. All of the people that we have interviewed in this book, all our friends, our brothers, our comrades, as many of them as possible come here to Washington, and we have a reunion, we have a dinner, we go together to the wall, the names of those who fell in the battles in the Ia Drang, 305 of them, are engraved on one single granite panel, the third one to the right of the apex of the Vietnam Memorial. We're older, and some of us are beat up and got gimpy legs, and some of them don't have arms, and some of them are half blind. But we come, and we go say something in our hearts to those we left behind.
General, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yes. Memorial Day, when I was a young boy, it was called Decoration Day. We'd go out to the cemeteries and put flags on the veterans' graves. But now it's turned into the beginning of summer with a three-day weekend. Veterans Day is always November 11th, no matter what day of the week it falls on, and this day has become to me a day of linking up with our dead. And I try to make it back to Washington every November since we began this Ia Drang Valley Band of Brothers alumni. And we go down to the wall and we communicate and hitch up with our dead. And let me tell you, it's a pretty heavy, very profound experience to do so when you see those names on that wall that you knew so well when they were in the prime of their youth, soldiers once and young. And it's tough, but it's also healing. And it's good to be there.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
General Harold Moore and journalist Joseph Galloway. Their new book is called We Were Soldiers Once and Young. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Make My Day. That line was made famous by Clint Eastwood and echoed by Ronald Reagan. Now it appears in Bartlett's quotations on the same page as Bruce Springsteen's lyric, "Tramps Like Us, Baby We Were Born to Run." You don't have to be highbrow to get into Bartlett's. We'll find out why from Justin Kaplan, who edited the new edition. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new reissue of recordings by the late contralto Kathleen Ferrier. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President-elect Bill Clinton has been given some advice on organization by 30 former government officials. A bipartisan commission of government veterans has released a series of recommendations that it says are necessary if the U.S. is to compete in the post-Cold War economy. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The commission's report was actually sent to the Clinton transition team and the president-elect last week. The central recommendation is for a stronger White House role in setting policy. The commission suggests the establishment of a domestic policy council and an economic council patterned after the National Security Council, an idea which Governor Clinton has partially embraced. The report also recommends upgrading the status of the U.S. Trade Representative and the status of the Environmental Protection Agency. As for national security, the commission recommends doing away with the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and establishing a new military command to support the United Nations military operations. Commission co-chairman Richard Holbrooke, former Secretary of State, says the aim is to make post-Cold War machinery fit post-Cold War priorities. Clinton spokesman George Stephanopoulos said today the transition team is giving strong consideration to the commission's report. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Officials of the European community have agreed to resume talks with the U.S. in an effort to head off a looming trade war. The Bush administration has threatened tariffs on selected EC imports early next month if no agreement is reached over farm subsidies. Paul Legg of the BBC reports.
There was never any doubt that the commission, which negotiates in trade matters on behalf of the community, would respond to a unanimous request from member states to resume the negotiations as soon as possible. Accordingly, and after a brief discussion, the commission spokesman, Bruno de Tomar, announced that the chief trade negotiator, Mr. Andreessen, and the farm commissioner, Mr. McSharry, would be seeking urgent meetings with their American counterparts. Mr. de Tomar said the talks were likely to take place in the United States next week. A commission vice president, Sir Leon Britton, refused to be drawn on suggestions that Mr. McSharry, who resigned as a GATT negotiator last week, had only agreed to rejoin the team after receiving assurances from the commission president, Mr. Delors, that he would not intervene in future negotiations.
Paul Legg reporting from Brussels. President Bush is on a fishing vacation on Florida's Gulf Coast. Aides say that Mr. Bush is planning no work during his five-day visit. A spokesman says the president telephoned President-elect Bill Clinton from Air Force One today and invited him to the White House for a private visit. Mrs. Bush is expected to travel to Houston from Florida and begin looking for a house to move into after Inauguration Day. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 15 points to close at 3,240. This is NPR News. In Jacksonville, Florida, police have announced that two teenagers have been arrested in connection with the wounding of a motorist on Interstate 295. Officials have been investigating a series of attacks on motorists along the interstate. One man was killed when he lost control of his car after it was hit by a piece of concrete. Interstate 295 is a major gateway to Florida for tourists heading south. And these recent attacks have resulted in a AAA warning to avoid the highway and the stationing of National Guardsmen along the highway to protect travelers. Prosecutors in Detroit say that they will not be able to issue warrants in connection with a fatal police beating case until late next week. Phil Denieri of member station WDET reports.
Wayne County Prosecutor John O'Hare says the complexity of his investigation requires him to take an additional week to decide what, if anything, the officers involved will be charged with. 7 Detroit police officers were suspended without pay after 2 officers allegedly beat 35-year-old Malice Green to death with flashlights while others watched. The police department wrapped up its internal investigation earlier this week, but prosecutors say the number of people involved and the need for more information mean criminal warrants won't be issued until the latter part of next week. Public officials and community members are clamoring for the accused officers to be brought to justice, but the prosecutor says he wants to be deliberate to make sure he has a legally sound case. For National Public Radio, this is Phil Denieri in Detroit.
Senator David Pryor will have a heart bypass operation tomorrow. Pryor suffered a heart attack more than a year ago, and spokesmen say that doctors have told him that bypass surgery will strengthen his heart and improve his health. The Arkansas Democrat is a close friend of Bill Clinton, and he has been mentioned as a possible White House chief of staff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. If you want to impress people with a perceptive quote, the place to turn is Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. The first volume was published in 1855 by John Bartlett. The 16th edition has just been published, and my guest is the editor, Justin Kaplan. Kaplan is the author of biographies of Walt Whitman, Mark Twain, and Lincoln Steffens. It's Veterans Day, so I looked up war in the index and found over a page of entries. I turned to the entry, War is Hell, and learned that that phrase comes from a military academy commencement address by General William Sherman in 1879. He said, "War is at best barbarism. Its glory is all moonshine. It is only those who have neither fired a shot nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood, more vengeance, more desolation. War is hell." Justin Kaplan has also included more contemporary quotes about war in the new Bartletts. This one is from the Francis Ford Coppola film Apocalypse Now. The line was spoken by Robert Duvall.
"I love the smell of napalm in the morning. It smells like victory." There's another quotation from a brilliant book by Michael Herr called Dispatches. And I'll read you two quotations from it. "I think Vietnam was what we had instead of happy childhoods," is one of them. And then the other quotation deals with, I think, the organic connection between the Vietnam War and rock lyrics. And that's one reason you'll find so many rock lyrics in the current edition. This again is from Herr's Dispatches. "Out on the street, I couldn't tell the Vietnam veterans from the rock and roll veterans. The 60s had made so many casualties. Its war and its music had run power off the same circuit for so long, they didn't even have to fuse."
So you told us why you chose the Michael Herr quote. What about the quote about napalm in the morning from Apocalypse Now?
Well, I thought that was Apocalypse Now certainly is a classic movie about the Vietnam era. But to go beyond that, I gave a fair amount of thought to where people get their quotations from these days. They don't, this is an obvious statement, they don't quote from Shakespeare and the Bible or Virgil as much as they used to. In fact, they don't quote from them at all. If you listen to the conversation of rather well-educated people, for example, meeting at a party, you'll find that the common ground that they immediately find is the movies. And the movies supply the so-called lingua franca of our era. The Italians, I'm told, think of the movies as the 10th muse and would not be surprised if the other 9 muses had to roll over to make room for it. I'm thinking, of course, of the Chuck Berry lyric, "Roll over Beethoven and tell Tchaikovsky the news." I hope it's not true, but the movies are important, and the movies are where most quotations these days come from.
Well, public radio listeners will be pleased to know that you quote Garrison Keillor.
Well, I thought he belonged here. I thought he was absolutely essential.
You want to read the quote?
Well, I put in 2 quotations from Garrison Keillor. I think both of them are firmly rooted in the American memory by now. "That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average." And, of course, the second is a description of the town. "It's the little town that time forgot, that the decades cannot improve."
I wonder if Garrison knows he's in here. Do you let people know that they're going to be in Bartlett's?
No, I let them find out the hard way simply by looking at the book. They do not get a letter of notification, no.
Well, Zippy the Pinhead fans will be pleased to know that you've quoted him as saying, "Are we having fun yet?" And Zippy the Pinhead is the cartoon creation of Bill Griffith.
I'm glad we put that in, and I know that Bill Griffith had a fair amount of trouble establishing his proprietary right in that line, because it had been attributed to, I think, various television shows or a movie. But I'm glad to say that justice has been done, finally.
James Brown has made it into Bartlett's. Say
yes.
It loud, I'm black and I'm proud.
Right.
Your choice?
I believe so, yes.
Now, there's a quote that our listeners will probably remember. "Love means not ever having to say you're sorry." That's Eric Siegel from the movie Love Story. How did you feel about having that in Bartlett's quotation? It's really, I think, one of the kind of cornier quotes, or it's certainly become that.
Well, it's certainly one of the stupidest single lines of dialogue ever written. But it is so stupid and so meaningless that, again, it became burned in the American memory. And I believe that there's a later movie in which Ryan O'Neill, who played in the original Love Story, another movie in which Ryan O'Neill quotes the line and says something like, "I think that's the stupidest thing I ever heard." Well, regardless of its stupidity, that's the one thing from Love Story that you can count on people remembering.
But you didn't feel the need to put in parentheses, "I, the editor of this edition, do not really believe this is a profound thought."
I do not indicate when I put a clothespin over my nose.
Now, if you were putting this together today, you know, if you were still editing the book, would James Stockdale's now famous quote of "Who am I? Why am I here?" be included?
I'm not sure. Again, it's a very close call between what you think will have lasting power. And I don't mean timelessness. I mean something that will last in the memory for 10 years. I somehow have the feeling that Stockdale's rather pathetic and appealing line, I have the feeling that won't last, that he was very much of a passing phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas certain obvious Bushisms and Reaganisms are burned in our memory.
Like what?
Well, 1,000 points of light. That phrase has been in existence since, it's written by
Peggy Noonan,
a brilliant speechwriter. That's been in existence since 1988, when Bush first uttered these words at the Republican National Convention in New Orleans. Well, by now, 1,000 points of light must have figured in at least 1,000 jokes, cartoons, quips, and so on. There was a Herb Block cartoon right after the convention which showed you two people sitting in a saloon, and one of them says, "Well, I guess he meant 1,000 pints of light beer." And then shortly after that, I remember that there was a full-page ad in the New York Times for a dress that Macy's was promoting. It was a sequin dress, and it said 1,000 points of light. And I think the comment on that enduring but meaningless phrase that I like most, and I forget who said it, the comment was that Bush unfortunately forgot to tell you that batteries were not included. I wish I could claim authorship of that quip. It's not mine.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Justin Kaplan, and he's edited a new edition of Bartlett's Quotations. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Justin Kaplan is my guest, and we're talking about Bartlett's Quotations. He edited the new edition, which has just been published. I sometimes think of Bartlett's Quotations as being a book for cheaters, for people who have a luncheon address or a speech they have to give, and they want to say something profound, so they'll quickly find a quote in Bartlett's. And then they'll say it as if these words have guided them all their life, you know, and that the person who they're quoting has been a lifelong influence upon them. And I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, that's one use for it. People do use quotations to to dress up their own thoughts to impress people. And Bartlett's, as a reference book, is an invaluable tool in doing that. But it, I think it goes way beyond that. I like to think of it not simply as a reference book, but as a reading book. It's a rather unique anthology. It is, after all, not arranged like a dictionary alphabetically, which is the way most quotation books are arranged. It's arranged chronologically, which seems at first glance rather odd and maybe a little unwieldy as far as using the book is concerned. But what that gives the book is a very special character of a reading book. You can start at the beginning with ancient Egypt, if you choose, and you work your way up to the present time. And you may have the feeling that you're hearing people of a certain era. You're getting the flavor of a certain era as time moves along.
Well, let me just underscore what you're saying by quoting Winston Churchill. And there's actually a quote about Bartlett's quotations within Bartlett's quotations. It's by Winston Churchill.
That, that's
it reads like this.
A little self-promotion.
Yes. Yeah. But you quote Churchill as saying, "It is a good thing for an uneducated man to read books of quotations. Bartlett's Familiar Quotations is an admirable work, and I studied it intently. The quotations, when engraved upon the memory, give you good thoughts. They also make you anxious to read the authors and look for more."
Well, I'm not sure that shouldn't have been on the jacket of this book instead of in the book itself.
A little blurb.
It's an internal blurb.
Have you had to speak at luncheons or anything in the past few years while you've been editing this book? And did you find yourself using quotes that you had been choosing to include in here? You know, did you become quite the quoter?
Well, I've always been a quoter. I think I'm trying to cure myself of that habit.
How have you used quotes?
I think very largely to illustrate the meaning of words or the development of ideas. You know, I don't use them to lend authority to what I say. That's one use of quotations. It doesn't happen to be mine. I could go on. I've given, obviously, a certain amount of thought to why and how people use quotations. And I think one way they use them is as passwords, as the equivalent of secret handshakes. If you make a reference that either a direct quotation or an allusion that the other person understands, you've established a certain bond. You can say, "I understand you. We speak the same language."
You're a biographer in addition
to editing
Bartlett's. And two of the people who you've written biographies of are two of the most quoted Americans, Mark Twain and Walt Whitman. Did you often see them quoted out of context or, you know, quoted, you know, with the wrong interpretation?
Well, Mark Twain is always being either overquoted or misquoted. And I did a certain amount of correction in the Mark Twain section here. I redid all of the Mark Twain quotations because I thought the Mark Twain that we value these days is much more Mark Twain, the satirist, and Mark Twain, the vernacular artist. And so I tended to reduce the amount of, you know, pure sentiment which some people associate with Mark Twain. In the way of restoring balance, I've restored to Mark Twain the famous quip, "Everyone grumbles about the weather, but no one does anything about it." My predecessors had attributed that to a friend of Mark Twain's named Charles Dudley Warner. I'm pretty sure that it belongs to Mark Twain. On the other hand, there's another quip that people have associated with Mark Twain, and that is, "Wagner's music is better than it sounds." But if you look at Mark Twain's autobiography, he directly attributes that to a fellow humorist named Bill Nye. And that's where the credit goes this time.
So it's time for us to wrap up. Should I ask you something silly, like, can you leave us with an inspiring quote? You must get asked this all the time. It must be really frustrating.
I suppose if I had to come up with an inspiring quote, it would be of a distinctly vernacular sort. It's a quotation attributed to Yogi Berra, and I have to underline the word attributed. I like it very much. It runs, "When you come to a fork in the road, take it." make of that what you want.
That's great. Justin Kaplan, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Justin Kaplan edited the new edition of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. This is Fresh Air. These are some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. Mara Liasson has the latest from Little Rock. President-elect Clinton's staff is putting together new ethics guidelines for appointees. And a look at some of the pledges Bill Clinton made on the campaign trail before he got elected. Eric Weiner has a report on which promises are easy to fulfill and which ones will be more difficult. Also a story about the Congressional Black Caucus. As a result of redistricting, the caucus now has 40 members and could emerge as a significant power bloc in the new Congress. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The British contralto Kathleen Ferrier was born in 1912 and died of cancer in 1953 at the age of 41. Her singing career lasted only 10 years, but classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says in that short period she made some of the century's most memorable recordings. London Records has just reissued most of them. Lloyd has this review.
I first heard Kathleen Ferrier on an album of Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde, The Song of the Earth. She made it in 1952 with Bruno Walter, the conductor who led the world premiere back in 1911. It's a staggering performance, a farewell to the earth sung by someone who must have known she was dying. Ferrier's warm, rich, natural voice sounds like a force of nature. It seems to well up from the very center of the earth. So it shouldn't be surprising that she made a career of singing the most profound music written for the alto register. Arias by Bach, Handel, and Purcell. Songs and song cycles by Schumann, Schubert, Wolf, and Brahms, and of course, Mahler. She was also a wonderful folk singer. She worked mostly in concert, but she was also famous for one operatic role, Orpheus in Gluck's Orfeo ed Euridice. Her last public appearance, only shortly before her death, was in a production of this opera at Covent Garden. Here's my favorite of her three recordings of Orpheus's big aria about losing Eurydice, the one she made in 1946 with Sir Malcolm Sargent in English. London Records has just released a 10-disc Kathleen Ferrier set of both studio recordings and live performances. The discs are also available separately. One highlight is a never-before-issued live recording of some Schubert songs with the composer Benjamin Britten accompanying Ferrier at the piano. That song was called Lachen und Weinen, Laughing and Weeping. In everything she did, you can hear the openness and spontaneity that everyone adored. Someone once played me a private recording that must have been taped at a party. She accompanies herself in a hilarious parody of a pompous British oratorio singer. Serious or funny, whatever she felt, she seemed to feel completely. In one Mahler performance with Bruno Walter, she couldn't sing the last word because she was overcome by tears. In fact, you can always hear the tears. They seem to be inherent in the very sound of her voice. Listen to her sing this great Mahler setting of a poem by Friedrich Ruckert, Ich bin der Welt abhanden gekommen. I have become lost to the world. Bruno Walter conducts the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. Along with the 10-disc Ferrier set, London has also issued in its historical series two magnificent discs of live performances, including Mahler's Kindertotenlieder, Songs on the Death of Children, and Ferrier's only recording of Mahler's Second Symphony. They're both conducted by another great Mahler disciple, Otto Klemperer. And in a lighter vein, she participates in Brahms's lilting love song waltzes. Ironically, while London has been reissuing all these discs, they have deleted from their catalog Ferrier's landmark Das Lied von der Erde, the one we heard at the beginning, with Bruno Walter, her most famous recording, and maybe her greatest of all.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and the author of the new collection of poems, Goodnight Gracie. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the music of Jelly Roll Morton, as interpreted by Vernell Bonnerice and Morton Gunnar Larson. They'll perform excerpts of their new show, which New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot described as a subtle, funny, graceful, haunting portrait of Jelly Roll Morton. Also, reviews of Dracula, the new movie, and the classic book. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.